You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today's guest is Stephen Sora. Stephen Sora started researching the Oak Island Mystery in the 1980s and later wrote Lost Treasure of the Knights Templar, followed by other titles, including Treasures from Heaven, Relics from Noah's Ark to the Shroud of Turin. He has appeared in documentaries on the Knights Templar, the Holy Grail, and the Oak Island Money Pit, participated in the DVD productions for the films National Treasure and Illuminating Angels and Demons, and is a contributor to Atlantis Rising magazine. He is a featured presenter at the upcoming Secret Teachings and Esoteric Wisdom Conference in Virginia Beach from May 18th to the 20th on Treasures from Heaven, Holy Artifacts and Architecture. You can find out more about Stephen Sora at his website, TemplarTreasure.com.
Thank you for coming on the show today.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, how did you become interested in sacred artifacts?
Kind of in a roundabout way. I got very involved in doing research on the Templars, and in part their kind of affiliation with St. John the Baptist and the different artifacts that they brought home from the East during the Crusades. And one thing just kind of led to another. I am Catholic, but I had no idea just how big the relic trade was and the use of relics were.
Your religious background, I guess, introduced you to that?
No, it actually didn't. It's kind of the opposite. There is a rule within the Catholic Church that every individual church has two relics in its altar. And this is something that I only found out about on a trip to Quebec. I visited the Cathedral of St. Anne, and I was told that artifacts from St. Anne, relics, actually bones, were under the altar. And I thought that was a little bit wild, one thing led to another, and I found out that it was a whole gigantic thing in medieval times. And it's still just as big today, that the trade in relics, the need for relics, and just what people do to go through to get those relics.
What are some of the artifacts you've researched?
The besides things like saint bones, which was really interesting, I did research into the Shroud of Turin, which is something I was interested in for a long time, not necessarily as a relic, but just as whether this could be true or not, whether it's a forgery or the real thing, and that was part of it. Noah's Ark is a very interesting topic, and a couple of American astronauts had got involved with it, and the CIA actually took photographs of what they call the Ark anomaly. It looks like an ark in a mountain in Turkey, and the Ark of the Covenant. The Spear of Destiny, the spear that supposedly was used to kill Jesus on the cross so his bones wouldn't be broken. Those things I knew from religion, from growing up Catholic and all. The real surprise was when it got to just what kind of relics the church saves and what relics they actually revere. In Rome, I went to see the finger of St. Thomas. St. Thomas was the one we called Doubting Thomas. When Jesus returned after his execution and was resurrected and met Thomas, Thomas didn't believe it was him, and he wanted to see the wound where the spear had penetrated Jesus. And so, famous painting, he puts his finger to the wound, and his finger is actually preserved in a church dedicated to him in Rome. And there's the arm of Paul, which is in a church in Malta. And unfortunately, there's a lot of fakes. Martin Luther once said, if there were only 12 apostles, how come the remains of 18 of them are in Germany? So, but every church has two relics, and the more important the church or cathedral, the more important the relic. In the medieval period, this was kind of the basis of tourism, that people would travel to a certain cathedral, maybe to see a relic, say a bone of Mary Magdalene, and as part of that they would bring gifts to the cathedral. So those cathedrals wanted the relics, and those relics attracted the tourists.
when did the church start revering the relics or placing importance on them?
Probably around the year 300, 400 AD. At first, any sort of image, and this goes back to the Jewish influence, a relic was something that was considered blasphemy, like the golden calf. And so it took a long time for anything that would represent a relic to be revered. It was kind of the opposite. People have always had, you know, their lucky charms. People take samples of their baby's hair to put in a book. People have lucky pens and things like that. And we save things from rock stars and movie actresses and whatever. And but the church originally, you couldn't even have a picture, say, of Jesus. And so it was around the time Constantinople became the major city that all of a sudden that whole attitude changed.
I guess you also have relics in the Greek Orthodox Church.
Very much so. And
wow.
It probably was more prominent there than, say, the Catholic Roman Church for the longest period of time.
Well, between the period, I guess, from the death of a saint to the period where these relics were found important, or the saints' bones, who kept the bones safe?
It could be anyone. Usually monasteries would, or different churches. Just as a really interesting example that kind of bowled me over when I first came across it, Juniper Serra was he was one of the priests, the Spanish priest that was in California, and he created the whole mission system of a mission being a certain distance from each other, and they would teach the native children in the ways of God. And the church really sees him as kind of a missionary that, you know, he preached to so many different people, so he was important. And now we live in kind of a politically correct period of time where they, or some people are against that. It's like the Spanish were the exploiters of the New World. And so some people don't respect him the way that the church does. So what happened a few years ago, the church really wanted to get him to sainthood. And so they actually had nuns in California that were shaving pieces of his bones that they preserved there. And what they would do is then offer, they can't sell the relic itself, which is, say, the bone. What they do is they place it in a reliquary, which holds it, and they can sell that. The distinction is really kind of a moot point, but that's how the trade goes on. And so just say somebody in New York City buys a little relic of Juniper Serra, and all of a sudden his cancer goes into remission. Well, that's miracle number one. And then, say, somewhere else, something great happens. That's miracle two, and that's all it takes then for him to be on the road to sainthood.
So then that's how relics have been traded, or I guess saints' bones in modern times, through reliquaries?
Yes, and it's really kind of a bizarre trade. It was when I started writing this, I had talked to my publisher at that time, was Wiley, and I talked to them about the topic and of the Shroud of Turin and some of the major things, and they sent me looking for others that really became much more interesting as time went on, for me at least, because I just didn't know that these things even existed. So I think it was Bishop Oscar Romero was saying Mass. He was gunned down, and this is, you know, just I guess about 15 years ago, and one of the priests ran out with a vial and collected his blood, and so his blood now is an important relic. And these things are traded between different churches, or they're made gifts of, like the Pope will say, okay, there's a new cathedral in the Philippines, and kind of to reward the fact that they spend so much money on it, he'll seize the opportunity and give a body part of somebody else to that cathedral. Recently, John Paul II made a gift of the a body part of Pope John the 23rd to such a cathedral. And it was interesting because the body of this pope who died in 1963 is considered to be in pristine condition, which kind of adds to the weight to make the case for his canonization.
When it comes to the bones of the apostles, have there been any cases that you can say that there's great evidence that that might be genuine?
there are different evidence. There's different evidence that's used to support that, but they have not been able to come up with a case of, say, any sort of DNA or anything that would actually make it, a solid evidence. They can say that, like in Rome, under the Vatican, they actually dug down under this altar about 20 feet. They found where the grave of St. Peter was, and they found all these different crypts, and one that indicated it was St. Peter. They took the bones out of there. They can say it belonged to a man that was in his 60s when he died, and some other evidence, but they can't say with any other certainty than that.
So then, in your book, Treasures from Heaven, Relics from Noah's Ark to the Shroud of Turin, I suppose you talk about saints' bones as well?
Yeah, it's an important part in the book.
We'll be right back with more. With Stephen Sora, you're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Stephen Sora.
Yeah, it's an important part in the book, especially the relic trade that goes on. I started reading about this, and I actually went to eBay, and my wife's name is Teresa, so I said, okay, there's a Saint Teresa in France who's really endeared to people. They call Teresa the Child. And so I wanted to see if I could buy a relic of her. And I bought it on eBay from someone in Ireland, and I got it 6 days later, and the total cost was under $10.
Hmm.
And now there's a lot of frauds on there, people that have a lot of things that eBay is now kind of policing. They're not allowing you to use certain terminology, although people do get around that. And a lot of these things, you know, people jokingly say if all the wood that was supposed to come from the cross of Christ was put together, it could build Noah's Ark. There are a lot of fraudulent relics that get traded as well.
Oh, yes, there's the, what is the wooden plaque? Jesus Nazareti Rex Judaeorum? I can't remember the name of the plaque.
Four letters, I-N-R-I.
Yes.
I did read about that. I don't know. I don't remember where that ended up. I think there's a cathedral in France where that may be. See, again, though, it's just very hard to say. The Spear of Destiny, the spear that Longinus had, there's so many different stories about that that I really believe that it's in the Habsburg Museum in Austria. But supposedly it's been around to many places. The Holy Grail, great story, you know, the cup that was used at the Last Supper. This went to St. Lawrence. St. Lawrence was brought before the Roman emperor, wherever he was, and he said that he wants him to turn over all the riches of the church and to present them to him. And so the next day, he came there with a bunch of poor and homeless people, and he said, these are the riches of the church. And then supposedly they put him on a grill and burned him to death. And while they were trying to do this, he actually didn't feel any pain. And he had given the grail to somebody else. That somebody else brought it to Spain, where it's in Valencia to this day. And I really believe that's the real artifact there.
I was wondering about that with the Holy Grail. Don't legends of the Holy Grail, I know it's, of course, you know, the cup spoken of in the Bible, they talk about that during the Last Supper, but weren't the legends about it created during the Middle Ages?
Or the importance of it? That's when the whole body of literature was put together as far as what the Grail actually is and where the Grail might be, which... you know, a lot of people would like to steer us to England, Glastonbury specifically.
You mean there's a genuine article out there that's been preserved? That's the Holy Grail?
Yes, and I believe it's the cup that's preserved in Valencia in Spain. There's another one in the Metropolitan Museum of Art that that also claims to be the cup, but, you know, there's several of them that are contenders.
This is information people can find out from your book, Treasures from Heaven.
Yes.
I was wondering about, I guess, talking about one of the major ones, another one, the Shroud of Turin. Could you tell us about the evidence for that?
this is the most remarkable story, because for the longest time there was a gap as far as what happened to it, and then all of a sudden it turns up in France in medieval times. And my book does trace the story from the time of Christ, and there's a king, Abgar, that lived in Edessa, and they called him Abgar the Black, and he wrote a letter to Jesus when Jesus was alive and said that he has a terrible disease, which people now think that most likely was leprosy because of his nickname, and Jesus wrote back that he would send somebody to him, but he couldn't come there himself. And what's remarkable in that sentence is that the Jesus wasn't known to have actually written anything. But one of the apostles then went to King Abgar, and what he brought him was the shroud, and it doesn't say if it healed him or not, but the shroud then was in that city. Now, 300 years later, it was moved to Constantinople, where it was preserved, and then finally during the Crusades, the First Crusade was actually kind of an abomination that was basically Christians attacking Christians in Constantinople, and they looted the city. And so that's these knights brought a lot of artifacts back, and it can be traced to a man with the name of De Charnay in France. His family were prominent among the Templars, and one of the two Templars that were burned at the stake, Jacques Molay being the head of the Templars, the other person was De Charnay. His family then later on presented it to the Duke of Savoy. And over all these years, the whole thing is fading away. It basically represents a man on both sides that would be about 6'2", and Christ was known to be taller than the average person at the time, and have evidence of the different horrors of the crucifixion that Jesus went through. So about 100 years ago, a man named Secundo Pia was asked to photograph the shroud, because at this point it was getting so worn just from existing that you could hardly see anything on it. And he photographed it, and the negative of it was actually a very distinct picture of Jesus, and with the wounds on the wrist and other wounds exactly where they should be. So I know that there are a lot of people that consider it a forgery, but I think part of that is through the years, it's been through two fires. There's been nuns ended up sewing on a background to it so it wouldn't get further damaged. And it was handled quite a bit, and I think that may lead to it. I really was convinced that when one scientist wrote that he was basically kind of agnostic and didn't have a bias either way, he said after doing the research they did, it was at the moment of transfiguration that Jesus, the body left the cloth that would have caused the image that it did. So my chapter on that is, you know, has the names of these people and everything, and just it was kind of convincing to me that, again, as a Catholic, I guess in part, but that this sounds like the real deal.
Oh, yes. Well, I understand that the carbon dating they've done on it was on a corner that had been repaired in the Middle Ages, or perhaps.
Exactly.
Yes, and that's. I don't know. I don't know much about it, just that there are images showing where they held it by that corner. But why would they carbon date a corner that had been repaired, or were they aware of that? Do you know?
I think there was so much politics. The church absolutely refuses to cooperate, and I think the reason is because they were always afraid that maybe it would be a fake, and certainly the cathedral at Turin, you know, gets a massive amount of people every 25 years when they bring it out. So it is kind of an important feature, even though the church as a whole doesn't actually say it's real or not real. But they just, they've kind of fought a lot of different efforts to have it tested. And I think because of what they handed over to be tested, it is actually part of the problem in getting it, you know, considered authentic.
Well, I was wondering also about another major relic you mentioned earlier, the Ararat anomaly. Do you know if there have been follow-up satellite photographs to that? I guess, what was that, the 80s or the 70s that they detected that, or was that earlier?
I think it was the 80s, but actually it was from pictures that they had taken much earlier, that the CIA spy planes, I think it was the U-2, whatever, that, and another plane, the SR-71, that they used to take these pictures from out in space, practically. That's where they came up with that. And it does look like there's a boat there, and a boat, you know, like a closed-up boat, which, you know, the Ark is meant to look like, which is kind of unusual. And so they've been, people have been making expeditions there, but because of the situation, like the Kurds, it's three different nations kind of at war with each other there, or, you know, at least their own Cold War. And so there's absolutely been nobody allowed in the last 20 years. That doesn't mean people haven't gone there. In fact, there's a Turkish-Chinese expedition that was made about a year and a half ago that they claim to have brought wood back to China. They tested it in a test to like 3200 BC, and which may or not be true. The Turkish government is very surprised because they never knew there was even an expedition there. And they certainly would not have been allowed to sneak in the country and make that expedition. Everybody that's asked for permission in the last 20 years has been turned down.
What do you think of the eyewitness accounts, like people drawing the Ark? I mean, do you think those are reliable?
I actually am like 50-50. I'm very suspicious with these different things. One expedition that got there said they went through a chambers of petrified wood, and it would just seem that if someone actually really got something, that you know, we would have got closer to revealing it and letting people see it and all. And I don't think we ever got to that point yet. So as much as there's some very serious people there and committed actually serious money to the expeditions, I'm still not sure that's the real thing there.
Oh, yes. So there are serious expeditions going on?
Not right now, there's not.
Ah, oh, goodness.
And for the last 20 years, there was one group, I forget the person's name, but they were all arrested.
Oh.
And the wife had campaigned online to get money to help them get out of the country. I can't think of the person's name. But this recent expedition may or may not have even taken place. The Turks can't believe it. The Chinese say they're 99.9% sure that this is actually wood that they brought back from the Ark. So, you know, in a case like that, it's very hard to, you know, to make a decision and say what you believe is true or not true.
Hmm. Oh, yes.
We'll be right back with more with Stephen Sora on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Let's continue our conversation with Stephen Sora.
I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that someone made kind of an unauthorized entry. There's been a handful of unauthorized entries under the dome in Jerusalem, the Temple of Solomon. And when people have found out to go there, there's actually been riots and Englishmen killed just for making that entry, because the Muslims, which now claim it, do not want anybody, you know, under the dome.
Do some people think that the Ark of the Covenant is buried under the temple somewhere?
Some people do. The Graham Hancock's book on it, called The Talisman, I think was one of the best research books that I saw. And he makes evidence that when the Queen of Sheba came to the temple, she was given it as a gift and brought it back to Ethiopia. And they have, they call them tablets, and they have them in a lot of different churches in Ethiopia. These are actually synagogues. And they have one that may or may not be real, that that Graham Hancock came across, but was not allowed to see it himself. But he believes that, and it gives the whole story about how it got there. He believes that that is authentic.
Do you agree with that?
I think he presents the strongest case for it being somewhere outside of the Temple of Solomon.
Well, I guess the Ark itself, that's something that could survive the test of time. It's gold over What type of wood is that? Acacia?
Yes.
Hmm. And the dimensions of it, I was wondering about that. I know that there's one scientist, I saw a documentary, I don't know how serious it was. He suggested that the Ark had been an African bowl, but that seemed way out there. So then what Graham Hancock is suggesting is that the Ark is in a shrine or temple and has been there in Ethiopia, I guess, for thousands of years.
2,000 years plus.
Wow.
And that, you know, they worship it as a very important relic, and that's why they have copies of them in so many different places. And he wanted to go to these different events where they take them out and view them, but he was never steered to the one. He wasn't allowed to see the one that he thought was authentic. He was steered to other ones that were most likely later copies.
I see. Now, you have a book on the Oak Island Mystery.
Well, actually, there's two books. There's The Lost Treasure of the Knights Templar, and the kind of follow-up to that was The Lost Colony of the Templars. And I got started on that when I was doing Templar research, and I had almost forever been doing research on Atlantic crossings before Columbus. And in a book, I guess, written about 1950, they talked about an expedition that had two Italians and a Sinclair from Scotland that crossed the ocean following basically the Viking trail, and had some interesting things in Nova Scotia and all the way down to Newport, Rhode Island. And so I never really knew who Sinclair was until my research to the Templars took me there. And when the Templars were arrested and their order disbanded in 1307, they looted the parish treasury of their order and to save it from the French king. So a lot of people believe there's one or two places that it went, Scotland or Portugal. There could actually be more places. There was something like a wagon train full of treasure that was loaded onto as many as 17 ships. And there's real testimony when the Templars were on trial in England. Two Templars both confessed to being a part of the operation that took these treasures out of Paris. So that's when the proverbial light bulb went off for me. I'm thinking the Sinclairs had something to hide, and in Nova Scotia, and the Sinclairs may or may not have gone to Nova Scotia, and in Nova Scotia was a hiding place that's just unbelievably constructed to prevent anyone from breaking in. And so that's when I thought, you know, this is worth following up on.
What happened next when you followed up?
Well, the first thing, I had gone up to Oak Island a couple of times, and David Tobias at the time was a bit younger, and he was in charge of the operation. He was committed that it was Sir Francis Drake. And after spending almost a year of researching year by year of Sir Francis Drake's life, I came to the conclusion that two things. One, he was never in Nova Scotia, and two, that he had absolutely no reason to hide any of his treasure. Queen Elizabeth, he was her man, and she went. She shared in the treasure that actually was enough money to build the British Navy, and basically she kind of defended him from Spain. When he got back and retired, he bought the house of his rival and built a whole waterway system in the town and everything. So he was open in his display of how much money he made from it. He had no reason to hide any of that money anywhere. And certainly it had to take about a year to build the Oak Island complex, which there is no missing year from his life. The only thing I found out is I believe that he went further north in California when he was in the Pacific Ocean. But otherwise, his whole life can be explained, and, you know, it's an open history.
Hmm.
So I followed up on the treasure goes up to Roslyn in Scotland, and there's caves there, and there's a lot of places that a treasure could be hidden. And 7 years after the Templars were basically kicked out of France, they were hiding in the north of Scotland. And the Battle of Bannockburn, which incredibly happened on June 24th, which is St. John the Baptist feast day, who's sacred to the Templars. the English always beat the Scottish, and you see all the movies where the Scots are, you know, dressed in blue paint, and they're fighting with sticks and stones against an army that has rifles and cannons. And at Bannockburn, the battle's going against the Scots, and all of a sudden a fresh force of cavalry rides out from nowhere and defeats the British and sends them further south, and they're chasing them, and then they stopped on June 24th to commemorate the Saints' Feast. And so the Templars definitely were in Scotland. Anyone that visits, especially north of Inverness, there's plenty of Templar graves to be seen, including at Roslyn, of course. And so now they have this treasure up there. Scotland's almost independent, although it's always under threat. And before the actual Reformation happened, there were people like Calvin and whatever that wanted to smash all the idols of the Roman Catholic Church, and the Sinclairs were ardent Catholics. So now they had something that they had to protect, and they needed some place to put that. So the expedition that someone had taken 50 years ago, Henry Sinclair, pointed to the New World in Nova Scotia, although it may not have been recognized as a New World at that point. So that's where the treasure was taken. I believe that what they call the Money Pit, the Oak Island Repository, was built around 1447, and there's actually runes up there which are incredible, that where people were probably housed and all, and then they left it there, and from one Sinclair member to another, the knowledge may have been passed on, but along the way it might have actually been lost also.
Well, I understand they found human relics buried on Oak Island.
They set the camera down about 200 feet, and they saw like the bones of a hand all the way down there. They no full bodies or anything, although six people have died trying to excavate the thing. They found some gold chain. They found parchment with only a couple letters that could be made out. So they also found flasks of mercury, which was really interesting because Sir Francis Bacon wrote something on how to preserve parchments for a long period of time.
Well, now, you're going to be speaking at the May 18th to the 20th conference, Secret Teachings and Esoteric Wisdom, at the ARE in Virginia Beach. What will you be talking about there? What subjects?
Well, I'm going to be speaking for two segments, and the first one's really going to cover a lot of the things we talked about today. As far as the church goes, it's going to end with St. John the Baptist and the significance of him in both Christian settings and pagan settings. And that segment is going to talk about just why certain things were built, like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the church in Damascus. It's actually an Islamic temple now. And what went on and why St. John was so important. The second segment is going to introduce him again and take off from there, and why these different buildings were built and what kind of significance they have. And in that segment, I'll discuss just how the Templars came to America, lead the whole Sinclair voyage down to Newport, Rhode Island, where one of these similar structures are built, and then end with Verrazano coming to see the Templar colony, which actually just kind of died out or, you know, assimilated into American Indian tribes.
We'll be right back with more with Stephen Sora on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We're back with Stephen Sora.
The architecture is basically an octagon in a circle, and octagon is number eight. Eight represents birth and rebirth, and St. John the Baptist, of course, you know, has a lot to do with that. And these structures are built all over the world, they're built to a certain setting that you can actually track the settings of the moon and sun on the solstice days from such a church in Newport, Rhode Island, all the way to a church in Bornholm, all the way to Italy and France. And so that's the importance of that topic.
So then these structures, or at least the ones in the Americas, are different culturally or structurally from what was commonly in that area? They stand out.
Oh, certainly.
Wow.
The one in Rhode Island, people have been debating, you know, what that could have been. Some people say it's a Viking tower, and similar towers are built in, like, Bornholm, which is Denmark, and in Norway, but not necessarily by the Vikings. And especially the Bornholm one and the Newport, Rhode Island one, they both have the windows in the same place, they both have the same measurements, and they both can be used as sort of solstice calendars. So, and they're built in what the Templars, in the same form the Templars called the Baptistery. So it was an important part of death and rebirth that the Templars, you know, why they revered St. John the Baptist.
Hmm. What is the main focus of your research now?
I've taken it a little bit further. In early colonization of the United States, I think, was also very important in relying on some of the knowledge that was going on in Europe at the time, like Rosicrucian thought. The Rosicrucians had a lot to do with Sir Francis Bacon. He also had a lot of documents that, you know, maybe were preserved in the United States. But when these Rosicrucians came over, they went to Philadelphia first, and there's a place called it's Wissahickon Creek, and the Kelpius Cave is there, and it's a big monument for Rosicrucianism, although it's very hard to find if you don't have help when you go there, even though it's a fairly populated area. From Philadelphia, these people went out to the middle of the state of Pennsylvania, where they actually built at Ephrata kind of a similar structure. It was two stories. The men would usually, like, wash themselves and things like that in the first story and then go to the second story of it, just like there is in Newport. And then they would have different ceremonies of sort of religious conduct, but it was nothing like the church has. It was very kind of different. I don't want to say pagan rites, but it had a lot to do with astronomy and things like that. So it's kind of one of those things that you don't really see, you know, in the history of the United States, but did occur in a big way. So the Rosicrucians and Sir Francis Bacon have a lot to do with the research I'm doing now.
Wow. And where can people find out more? What's your website?
I don't cover it on the website yet. I do have a website called TemplarTreasure.com, and kind of gives the basic stories to the different books that I published.
And we're about out of time. Do you have any final thoughts before we go?
No, I think I really look forward to the meeting, and I hope that people have an open mind in doing this research. A lot of times I run into people that, you know, they're too Catholic or they're too atheist or whatever, and they find their own example. But I believe in the Thomas Mann sense of the word, that anything's possible. So, and I look forward to meeting everybody.
Oh, yes. And thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
It's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Kimberly Rose. To find out more, go to kimmyrose.com. That's KimmyRose.com. Well, hello.
Hi.
And what's today's Thought for the Day?
This is reading 47037. Don't get mad and don't cuss a body out mentally or in voice. This brings more poisons than may be created by even taking foods that aren't good.
Wow.
Yeah, you're good at this one.
Oh, yes?
Because
cursing?
No, you bring up, I've talked to you several times, and you're good about watching what you know, eat, or, you know, drinking water, but I'm not sure if you're good at it's thoughts create things, you know what I mean? And so you're very good at taking care of your body in a physical way, but this is really interesting because, like Louise Hay says, you know, what we say, we project within ourselves. And even Wayne Dyer says, that when you're driving and you get mad at somebody, you've just killed cells in your brain cells, and you're, and it, it's in, and if you think about it, when you get mad, you hold your breath and your body's not getting the oxygen in it.
Hmm. Well, I know that in the New Testament, it says not to use foul language. And I always wondered about that, you know, what, you know, does that have to do with spirituality, I guess, if somebody's using foul language? I was just curious about the connection, and it just says in the Bible, don't use foul language. And a lot of things it says and we don't understand, but it's interesting that Edgar Cayce said something similar, and he elaborated that this brings more poisons than may be created by taking foods that aren't good. So that just reemphasizes that. I mean, even somebody might think if they're in their car, they can do all that. But, yeah, like you said, by saying it, it creates negativity that you're just piling on yourself, I guess.
That's the truth. And that I like the way that Edgar Cayce, I really believe that he was connecting with that truth. It's the vibration. And Edgar Cayce is all, you know, talks all about vibration. Kevin Tedeschi wrote a book on, you know, vibration. And that makes sense, is it instills that negativity within you.
Wow. Well, thank you for doing the Thought for the Day today.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks to Stephen Sora for talking to us. You can find out more at his website, TemplarTreasure.com. Also, he'll be speaking at the upcoming Secret Teachings and Esoteric Wisdom Conference in Virginia Beach from May 18th to the 20th. To find out more, go to EdgarCayce.org, click on Events, and then click on Conferences. Thanks also to Kimberly Rose for the Thought for the Day, and most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce.